It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. A place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Now in the center of our service, in the center of our lives, we make room for life's quieter moments. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly remembering who you are and why you are here. Let us join together in an attitude of prayer. May we be granted a saving vision, a vision of wholeness, of justice and compassion, a vision of peace. May we be granted that saving vision. We struggle each day in this land of partial visions, where whole armies and unholy laws serve those whose half-truths have achieved fearful power. When it is too much, too unrealistic to hope for the victory of more adequate visions, let us keep the faith that we may have those visions of a healthier kind of wholeness. And let us be sustained and carried forward by them. In our lives, in our families, our relationships, in our nation and in our world, we usually stumble not because we are bad, but because we can't see clearly enough to discern a higher path. We slip back into our frustrating ruts because we cannot see a better road. It is said that the longest trip begins with the first step, but even before the first step, it begins with a vision of where we need to step, where our road needs to lead us. And so may we be granted a saving vision, a vision of wholeness, of justice and compassion, a vision of peace. May we be granted that saving vision for our lives, our families, our relationships, our nation, and our world. Amen. The title for this sermon was Looking Back, Looking Forward, and somehow the last half got left off, which is pretty funny. But I want to start in Looking Back, Looking Forward by looking back to a very old story, and I think not a very well-known story, but one of my very favorite stories from the Hebrew Scriptures. It's just a little thing, just about three paragraphs long. I'll read it to you from the book of Deuteronomy, which is not one of my favorite books in that Bible either. So it's a diamond in the rough, this story. And Yahweh said to Moses, "Ascend this mountain, Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab opposite Jericho, and view the land of Canaan, which I give to the people of Israel for possession. And die on the mountain which you ascend, and be gathered to your people. For you shall see the land before you, but you shall not go there into the land which I give to the people of Israel." And Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, and Yahweh showed him all the land. And Yahweh said to Moses, "This is the land which I promised to Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob, saying, 'I will give it to your descendants.' I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there." So Moses died there in the land of Moab, never entering the promised land. But the story not many people know. It doesn't have the kind of ending it's supposed to have, or that we think it had. There are these people in the wilderness. They've been wandering around there for 40 years. This land that doesn't feel like a home. And their leader is taken up to the top of a mountain and given a wonderful vision of a land where everything is milk and honey and peace and justice and all those wonderful things. This is not your run-of-the-mill view, this view from Mount Nebo. It's not a view you can see from below. The people of Gilead don't see it, nor the people of Judah, and Moses' people don't see it either. Their visions are so much more limited. They're just trying to survive down there, to make it through the day. And all these people are in their way. All these other tribes are in their way. They each have their own small territories, which they defend ferociously and in the name of their gods, as always. They each have their own little cities and villages of darkness and partial vision, and they cluster there in their tight little knots to protect their flanks, and they constitute something of the human condition. But then in the myth, this one man is given a view almost beyond belief. Someday, he's told, this land will be a place where enemies have learned to be friends, war has given way to peace, and the people are at last one. Then he's told, oh, by the way, you won't live to see it. Long before the fractious nature of the world ends, you will end. Now, go back and tell your people about this wonderful vision of the promised land that you won't live to see. And make them believe it. And help them seek it. Maybe they'll live to see what's beyond the reach of your own lifetime. Then the story says Moses died, and his people finally entered the promised land, and after defeating all the other inhabitants who hadn't thought of it as a promised land to Moses' people, after defeating all of them through a series of wars, they claimed the land as their own, which they're still doing in our own time. Now there we've left religion and entered irony. We've come back into tribalism. There they missed the point the story had made, that the promised land is a land without the tribes, without the borders, without the turf battles, a land united by a larger vision than we want to see. So I wonder, is that where the story end and reality returned? That after this mythic image, the people came back on stage and messed it up? Because grand visions aren't things we do very well, and they're very hard to live. I'm not sure how a story could be more timeless or more true to the human condition than this one. It's incredible that it's 25 or 30 centuries old and feels as relevant today as it did then. I think more than any other single thing today, we lack a shared vision with enough breadth and scope and depth to bring us together. We're disjointed. We're people or peoples, but we're not a people. We're like a landscape filled with potted plants, maybe, but not a garden. Lacking a shared vision, we define ourselves by partial visions, just as in the story of Mount Nebo. And this sets person against person and group against group. The very differences we have in sex or race or belief or political bias which separate us and make us different from others, these are the things we use to define ourselves against the others and partition ourselves off from those horrible foreign people. No one has a view of the whole. There's a famous passage in the Bible which has apparently been famously mistranslated. The mistranslation is, without a vision, the people perish. One of the more famous passages in the Hebrew Scriptures. The actual, more accurate translation seems to be, without strong leaders, the people go astray. Both seem true. So we have a view from the liberal tribe, or we have a view from the conservative tribe. We're offered the choices between being Republicans or Democrats. Nature has made us straight or gay, male or female, white or black, and the rest. We define ourselves by our differences, and then we fight for these differences. But this old story, this wonderful old story, says that every victory for a partial vision is a defeat of the vision of a promised land. I've wondered sometimes what today's version of the view from Mount Nebo would be, and we have one. We have one even more vivid than the vision from this old story. Almost no one here knows where Gilead and the rest of these places even are. It's not a very helpful vision. But we not only have a vision of the modern view from Mount Nebo, we have a photograph of it for the first time in history. I think it's that photograph of the Earth taken from the surface of the moon. Here's a planet with no boundaries, no borders, no people defined by differences. One little living whole green island in the middle of space. The little visions that served us don't serve us well. Nationalism served us once. It bonded the people of one country together, made them one against the rest. But now the territory we need to care about isn't a nation. It's a whole planet. And so the same spirit of nationalism which brought us together is now driving us apart. And religion can't bind us together today. Like nationalism, it only worked within its boundaries. The Baptist can only make you whole if you're another Baptist. The Muslims can welcome people of the book, but they don't include Hindus in that, or Buddhists. So every religion, like every nationalism, is one of these people in the tribe in the old story, standing on the ground with a vision too small to include people who aren't like them. Joseph Campbell said once that in this world, general propaganda for one or another of the local solutions is now superfluous, or much rather, he said, a menace. Religions can't bring us together. Though each religion can, if it will be true to its best stories, point us toward the place where we might someday come together. I want to be redundantly clear about this promised land business. I think poetry can get us in trouble in religion if we don't stop to remember where poetry leaves off and reality begins. I don't for one minute believe that the world will ever be united into one happy group of warless people with no significant differences. If the wolf lies down with the lamb won't get up again. This is mythic language, not historical language. And the fact that we've been saying this and telling these stories for 25 centuries should be enough evidence that this is the human condition they're describing, not a problem that we're going to solve in the next election. Mythic language isn't about history. Mythic language is about hope. These stories, like the view from Mount Nebo, are like the North Star. They're transcendent sighting points we can use to steer by. And the fact that we'll never reach the vision, that we'll probably all die, even on Mount Nebo, shouldn't be any more discouraging than the fact that sailors have been steering by the North Star for over 3,000 years and they've never reached it either. It's how we find the best kind of path we know to find. But I think this vision, this view from Mount Nebo, this picture of the earth as whole and alive, is the vision that has to inspire us if we're to live this life deeply and caringly, if we're to aspire to become most fully human or most fully divine, pick your metaphor. And it's fundamentally different from the visions which really do rule the world now and 2,500 years ago. It's a vision calling us to see each other not in terms of our differences, but in terms of those human commonalities that could make us one. It is a vision of the earth, like that picture taken from the moon. The promised land would be what the world would be like if everyone lived as though it could be true. That's what I think we're called to do. I think that's the fundamental religious task today, the task of finding a vision that partially negates and transcends the visions that have given us our small identities. I'll give you two examples of more recent people than 2,500 years ago who preached and tried to live this way. I read recently, secondhand, thirdhand, I've never really found the original sources on this, but I read it and liked it, so I believe it, that some of the Native Americans, American Indians, had a policy that came from this place of greater vision, that when they had to make a major decision for the tribe and the Grand Council was called together, they were commanded to make the decision based upon the effects that decision would have on the next seven generations. That's about 150 or 200 years. Can you imagine what our world today would be like if all major decisions concerning the environment, social programs, and war were made taking into account their effect on the next seven generations? Or how grateful we would be if that had been the law of the land for the last six generations? There's a view from Mount Nebo. The second example is one that you will know, though you may not be aware of the source of the story, and that's part of the point. It was from 36 years ago, April 3rd, 1968, to be exact. It was in a speech delivered by Martin Luther King Jr. just a few days before he was murdered. You probably heard these words, but unless you knew this old Bible story, you may not have known what the words were about, what he was talking about. Here's what King wrote. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I won't mind. Like anybody, I'd like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up that mountain, Mount Nebo. And I've looked over and I have seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get there to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. For mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. Every time I revisit that man's language, it's just poetry and prophecy tied together in such a magnificent style. I don't think we've had anyone like him since. So this story about Mount Nebo is not as ancient or forgotten as we may have thought. And one of its messages is that we'll be judged, you and I, both by ourselves and by others, according to the bigness of the vision we choose to serve. I think long after Malcolm X or Louis Farrakhan have been forgotten, Martin Luther King will be remembered and quoted and missed because he did have a view from that mountain. And we yearn for that so deeply. And he proclaimed that promise and he lived it, even though he suspected that he, like Moses, wouldn't live to see it fulfilled. Well, neither will we. But we will be remembered according to the greatness of the vision that we served. And it's far nobler to struggle with a great vision than to master a mediocre one. We gather at this church and at many churches today to ponder things like this. But I want to say there's more to it than that. It's not just a mind game, this religion business. There are things at the depth of life which command us. Things which say, look, you have to care about this. You have to care about the people who need you and love you. You have to care about the weaker and the poor and the disenfranchised and the innocent. You have to care about the planet that's your home. Whether you like it or not, whether it's intellectually interesting or not, there are things you are simply called to do. The view from Mount Nebo is not the view looking back toward our own small group, trying to see the whole world in terms of only our own biases. It's looking forward to a place we've never been, to a vision of foreigners become friends, strangers become brothers and sisters, a place where the deep awareness of our commonalities is so strong that it can absorb our differences. We won't live to reach the promised land. That's not our goal. Our goal is to live to reach the vision, to begin to see what life might look like seen from that perspective. This community needs us. This country needs us. The world needs us. We don't need more ways to be apart. We need more ways to be together. And the whole human sound still goes up only from the full choir. Partial visions must be replaced by more complete ones. Who will do it if not us? New moral perspectives are needed on so many issues, questions and problems which neither Democrats nor Republicans seem interested in solving. There are hungry and desperate people in our town, in our country, in our world. Who will care for them if not for us? 3 days ago, December 23rd, one of Austin's homeless people, we think, broke into our church again. There was no great damage done, broke a window, tore a box off the wall looking for money. This wasn't a big thing, but it was a very sad thing. It's a very sad thing to have someone break into a church looking for money. Who will help these people, if not us? The view from Mount Nebo is a view of the promised land, and it's a metaphor. It uses geographical symbols and describes this land as if it were out there somewhere. But you can't get there in a car. It isn't about geography. Like all religious language, it points within and among, not somewhere else. The view from Mount Nebo is the vision of a coordinated soul and an integrated world, united with its own depths. And the journey begins here in Austin, Texas, on December 25th, 2004, the day after another Christmas. It begins in our own hearts and souls. It can begin simply with a recognition, a feeling, a tear, or a touch. It seems a simple, even an ineffectual beginning. And what a grand vision. A world made whole where a vulnerable and simple truth is honored more than powerful lies. Where naked humanity trumps an ensconced hierarchy. It's a vision of what's been called a world of truth, justice, and love, the kingdom of God, the promised land. We won't live to see the whole thing. Neither did Moses, neither did Martin Luther King Jr. But to be inspired by that vision rather than lesser visions, to be inspired by the view from a Mount Nebo, and actually to begin taking steps toward it. That view and those steps can transform all the lives they touch, including ours, even here, even now.